teach Hawaiian studies at the University of Hawaii, Maui College. Can you tell us what it means to say that Lahaina, Lahaina Town, is the capital of the Hawaiian kingdom? Give us a brief history, how Hawaii became a part of the United States and what its relationship is with the mainland. What should we should understand about the historic nature of Lahaina Town? I find the rest of the media talks about the tourist destination, but there's a reason for that, is because it is so historic.
Yeah, you know, Lahaina is one of those places, you know, some of the most beautiful beaches in the world. It's on the leeward side of the mountain, so it's very warm. It was also a place of lots of water. So this is one of the things also maybe we had a chance to talk about later. Historically, it was the capital in, you know, ancient times, from ancient times immemorial, really of the island of Maui, where the seat of government would be held. Many of the highest ranking so-called chiefs held court in Lahaina. In fact, right in the middle of Lahaina was a little island in a little like fishpond lake area called Moku'ula, where, you know, the highest ranking chiefs and some of the most sacred items and so-called Akua gods would be housed. And so from time immemorial, you know, Lahaina was always seen as a really important breadbasket of the island of Maui, therefore a central place of the island. And into more modern history, Lahaina specifically was the, you know, really the capital of the Kingdom of Hawaii, and that's because of its protected and sheltered waters from the ocean, you know, right into the early whaling period, in fact, into the beginning of the Hawaiian Kingdom. And it's really during the Hawaiian Kingdom period that Lahaina starts to play a very important role as a kind of a commercial center for trade, where ships from all over the world would dock and so forth. And so, you know, Lahaina becomes a place where, you know, it's kind of like the crossroads of the Pacific with many ships. And just to kind of add, you know, the royal so-called family being raised in Lahaina during the early 1800s, where Hawaii for a short period, in fact, was a protectorate under British Empire, part of the British Empire. And in later on in 1839, the first Declaration of Rights, followed by 1840, the first Hawaiian Constitution was written right actually in Lahaina. And she really was a seat of the government. People don't recognize the first so-called school, not just in Hawaii and the Pacific, but, you know, many times in the context of putting Hawaii within the context of the United States. You know, it's said that Lahaina Luna, which is a school, was started in 1831, is considered the oldest, you know, school west of the so-called Rockies. And so, you know, for a long period up into the mid-1850s, you know, Hawaii was seen as, again, the main capital. You know, during that period of growth, especially economic growth, there was a huge transformation where agriculture, and because of the large amounts of water in that area, in fact, the major area in Lahaina, one of the names, in fact, was Waine'e. The word Waie means water. The word Ne'e means to move. You know, unfortunately today, most of that water no longer exists due to streams which have been diverted. The transformation of the environment from, you know, traditional native plants and the so-called forests, which had been replaced first by sugar, and then now unfortunately being replaced by these what we call gentleman estates. These are, you know, very wealthy so-called mansions that are built in these areas. And so, you know, you can see there's a transformation where Lahaina one time was a very important agricultural center, commercial trade center, to the whaling period, and then became a large sugar plantation area. And then in the 1960s, really began the transformation of Lahaina really into a resort area. And so you had the vestiges of this real old kind of sense of a sea town, then slowly being replaced with what becomes, you know, commercialized tourist-sized centers. And right down the line of Lahaina Town, you have Ka'anapali, which is a, you know, major, and Kapalu are major resort areas. And so the economy, the population, and the landscape itself was transformed really to meet the needs of mass tourism. And I think that's also one of the issues that you'll find if you look deep enough, you kind of find which caused major transformation of the land itself. And so therefore, you know, and then you compound that, I think, with the issues today we have with global warming and so forth. And you can see the extremes of winds and extremes perhaps of heat and the drying up of the land itself and the denuding of the land itself, which really helped to spark, you know, really became the tinder for this matchbox that later exploded like a bomb in Lahaina. And, you know, unfortunately and horrifically, you know, our people who have lived there since time immemorial, you know, are suffering because of the consequences that have been, you know, imposed really from outside foreign forces.
In a moment, we're going to speak with the world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann. But I wanted to ask you, Professor Kaeo, about the mutual aid on the ground, and also ask you about the demographics of Maui in terms of Native Hawaiians, if you can talk about that, and then what kind of help is most needed at this point?
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, so, you know, right now, it was a very, very slow process and low start, I can say, from the very beginning, just slowly getting aid. And so it's only recently, I'm probably like in the last 24 hours, I would think that you have much of the supplies and aid that's needed have slowly has trickled in into the Lahaina area. And I understand, you know, part of it, of course, is difficult because it's still a very dangerous place because of the fires. And so, you know, fortunately enough, you know, because of the work of the community, and I got to really, really praise our community, you know, both Hawaiian and non-Hawaiian community. Many of people have, again, lived here for generations, and those who have recently moved here, including visitors, have all chipped in and worked hard to show their aloha and love for our place by participating and really providing the kind of supplies. And, you know, I, you know, was warned by seeing that even when, you know, you know, unfortunately, I think government failed in regards to providing the necessities of protection and safety and health for our people. You know, our people stepped up, and, you know, I myself was able to participate in bringing in supplies by boat, you know, so-called by boat, because we weren't allowed to drive into the area. And by boat, much of the supplies had been brought in. And then later on, even by today, by small planes, people started to bring in supplies. You know, hopefully this continues, and hopefully, you know, whether it's medical concerns or providing the kind of, you know, just bringing in people to come in to look at whether or not we have poisons or we have the ash and the soot and what you might find as remnants from homes and paint and, you know, lead and whatever you might have.
We just have 30 seconds, but are you concerned in the rebuilding process of Native Hawaiians being pushed out?
Yes, I think that's a very important point. My big concern, in fact, has been that really at the forefront or at the head of the table is that the Native Hawaiian population, the families who are from, again, since time immemorial in Lahaina, should be at the forefront in developing, managing, and planning, not just what's going on now, but really in the revitalization in Lahaina to ensure, in fact, that Native Hawaiian population continues to exist and it doesn't become replaced. You know, as a saying that, you know, this idea that the so-called to supplant the Native. And I kind of always chant the idea to replant the Native into places like Lahaina. And, you know, hopefully we're able to garner enough push and political support to ensure that the community leaders of Lahaina help to define what's best for Lahaina in the future.
Kalikoa Kaeo, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Professor of Hawaiian Studies at the University of Hawaii, Maui College, speaking to us on Maui. Coming up, we'll speak to climate scientist Michael Mann, and then to Ecuador. Stay with us.
Every day is a new day. 'Cause I can't remember what I did yesterday. Every day is a new day. 'Cause I can't remember what I did yesterday.
Adios a mi memoria, goodbye to my memory, by Maria Uspec, an Ecuadorian musician. Later in the show, we'll go to Quito for an update on the assassination of the presidential hopeful Fernando Villavicencio. But first, this is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We look at how the fires in Hawaii, it killed at least 100 people and likely far more, were made worse by the climate crisis, which has led to a rise in temperatures at the same same time Hawaii is facing a drought. This was amplified by Hurricane Dora Tuesday when it passed south of Hawaii, hundreds of miles away, as a Category 4 storm quickly spread the fire. Climate change is also linked to stronger hurricanes. Last week, the scientist Michael Mann wrote on social media, "What we're seeing in Maui is a compound climate catastrophe, where an immediate factor, in this case unusually strong winds from the outer bands of a passing hurricane, interact with background state extreme drought that has been in place for a month." Michael Mann joins us now, presidential distinguished professor and director of the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability and Media at the University of Pennsylvania. His upcoming book is Our Fragile Moment, How Lessons from Earth's Past Can Help Us Survive the Climate Crisis. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Mann. If you can start off by making that link, as many say, no, this is about weather. It's nothing to do with the climate crisis. Teach.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. It's good to be with you, although it seems we never have good news to talk about. And the stories that we've heard reported here are just so harrowing. And this is the climate crisis. It's here and now. It's impacting us today in profound ways. And this is what, just the latest example. And there is clearly a climate component to what's happened here, a climate change component. Those winds that you talked about are governed by differences in pressure, in surface pressure. A hurricane is a low-pressure system. In the subtropics, you have high pressures. And the difference between them, the gradient, as we call it, in pressure between the high and the low, is what determines the strength of those winds. And so we have higher and higher pressure over time in this region of the world associated with the changing atmospheric circulation associated with climate change. High pressure to the north. We had a storm, a rapidly intensifying storm, and climate change encourages rapid intensification of these storms that gave us that low pressure to the south. That difference in pressure gave us those huge winds, and it interacted with an epic drought. And that drought is part of the climate story here as well. As we see more and more high pressure in the summer over this region of the planet, we see less rainfall. Hotter temperatures mean more evaporation of what soil moisture there is. And so we see this epic drought. The winds did sort of provide the spark, in a sense. The downed power lines provided the spark. But what allowed these fires to spread so quickly, to become so damaging, was in substantial part the huge amount of fuel there was in the form of dry materials, the tinderbox conditions that are there today. All of those things have been impacted by climate change. So we can't tell this story without talking about the climate crisis.
I want to turn right now to President Biden. Last week, during an interview with the Weather Channel, meteorologist Stephanie Abrams asked him, he was in Arizona at the time, asked President Biden to talk about a climate emergency. President Biden said he'd practically declared a climate emergency.
Mr. President, you call climate change a code red for humanity. The World Health Organization said it will cause an additional 250,000 deaths a year starting in 2030. Are you prepared to declare a national emergency with respect to climate change?
I've already done that. National, we've conserved more land. We've moved into, we've rejoined the Paris Climate Accord. We've passed a $368 billion climate control facility. We're moving. It is the existential threat to humanity.
So you've already declared that national emergency?
Practically speaking, yes.
Yeah. Practically speaking. Michael Mann, could you explain what it would mean if a climate emergency were declared in this country?
Yeah, so there was a little bit of word evasion there, I suppose, in President Biden's response, because of course, what that means specifically, declaring a national emergency, is that you can bring funds immediately to bear on the problem. It's something that the chief executive can do through executive authority. Now, I imagine the president is a bit averse to declaring a national emergency. emergency, because we've seen that abused. For example, Donald Trump tried to use that as a pretext for building his war at the southern border. So I think there's sort of some, there is some concern about how that can be abused. The climate crisis is this continually evolving and worsening crisis. So declaring it as an emergency sort of sounds like we're talking about an acute problem, like we can just bring a whole bunch of resources to bear, solve the problem, and we're done. That's not what's going on here. We, of course, have to continue to provide more and more resources to bring to bear. We need policies that will get us off fossil fuels as quickly as possible. Now, the president's right. The Inflation Reduction Act that he signed into law last year, that does get us somewhere down the road, but it doesn't go far enough. We need more action. The president is somewhat limited right now by a split Congress, Republicans who will oppose everything he tries to do, and he's encountering resistance with the conservative court system now. So when he tries to, for example, block pipelines through executive authority, the court system is rejecting those attempts. And so what it comes down to is us. We've got to turn out in droves. Those of us who care about the climate crisis have to turn out in droves in the next election and elect climate-forward politicians, because we will not see the progress that we need without massive policy support, without overwhelming majorities in the Senate and Congress, and a president who will all work together to solve what is the defining crisis of our time, the climate crisis.
Michael Mann, I hope we'll be coming back to you soon. Presidential Distinguished Professor and Director of the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability, and the Media at the University of Pennsylvania. Author of the forthcoming book, Our Fragile Moment, How Lessons from Earth's Past Can Help Us Survive the Climate Crisis. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Ecuador to look at last week's assassination of presidential hopeful Fernando Villavicencio. He was shot dead at a campaign rally on Wednesday in Quito. He was shot in the head three times. He was running on a platform opposing corruption and organized crime. His death came just 10 days before Ecuador's general election, which is scheduled to proceed on Sunday as planned. Authorities in Ecuador have arrested six people in connection with the murder. One suspect was killed. Officials said all of the suspects in custody are Colombian and alleged members of a drug trafficking group. Over the weekend, Villavicencio's party, the Build Ecuador movement, tapped journalist Christian Zurita to replace him as its presidential candidate, reversing an earlier decision to go with Villavicencio's running mate, Andre Gonzalez, because they were concerned that since she was on as VP candidate, she might be disqualified in running for president. Christian Zurita spoke in Quito Sunday.
Fernando's ideas and our government plan are totally intact, and we are going to fulfill them. Together with him, we created this anti-terrorism plan, this anti-mafia plan to protect Ecuador.
On Sunday night, presidential candidates took part in a debate where they vowed to address violence and security issues. An empty podium stood in Villavicencio's place. They observed a moment of silence. This is presidential frontrunner Luisa Gonzalez of the Citizen Revolution Movement.
We already did it once. We'll return security on the streets so they don't kill us with a firm hand against crime.
That was Ecuador's presidential frontrunner, Luisa Gonzalez of the Citizen Revolution Movement. We go now to Guayaquil, Ecuador, where we're joined by her running mate, the economist, former presidential candidate Andrés Arauz. He served as director of Ecuador's central bank, then minister of knowledge and human talent under former President Rafael Correa. You can go to democracynow.org to see our interviews with President Correa when he was president. Our guest is now joining us from Quito. Thanks so much for being with us. Can you start off by responding to the assassination of Villavicencio?
Thank you, Amy. Good morning. Yes, we are extremely concerned about the assassination of Fernando Villavicencio. This is a direct attack on Ecuador's democracy. It cannot remain in impunity. We, unfortunately, are extremely we suspect that there is a direct link between the current government. There is wide enough evidence, ample evidence, that shows that there have been clear omissions and responsibilities in the security team directed by the National Police that was supposed to protect him. There is even evidence of negligence in this case, and it is extremely worrisome because it is an attack on democracy and it is an attack on all of us, all Ecuadorians. We are precisely in this election. It's a snap election because of Ecuadorian President Guillermo Lasso's links to narco-trafficking organizations. The famous León de Troya report that showed that he had links to the narco-trafficking mafias even in the early stages of his government, and that unfortunately for the first time in Ecuador have led this country into being completely polluted with narco-trafficking organizations in the highest levels of government. Mm.
A week before his murder, the slain presidential candidate had accused Adolfo Fito Macias of threatening him and his campaign team. He's in prison, and this weekend authorities went to the prison and moved him to a high-security prison. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Yes, it's a move that has been widely expected and been something that Ecuadorian society has been pressuring for a long time. But Guillermo Lasso's government had been quite reticent from doing that because of suspected links with this organization, with this criminal organization. Just a couple of weeks ago, after the assassination of the mayor of Manta, one of the biggest cities in Ecuador, Fito, precisely this character, was giving a press conference from within the jail, from within prison, escorted by a police intelligence officer. So it really is worrisome. We see that there are clear links between the current government and these mafia organizations. The U.S. ambassador to Ecuador in December of 2021 accused of the Ecuadorian police being filled with narco generals. And unfortunately, our prosecutor's office in the Ecuadorian government has not gone forward with the investigations since then. We also think that the government has prime responsibility in this murder because of specific statements from Villavicencio's widow, from his sister, and from now his former political mate from his political party, specifically Captain Edwin Ortega, a former military officer, who has said that characters like Maria Paula Romo have close links to the intelligence establishment in Ecuador and are now trying to persecute him for disagreeing in the replacement of Fernando Villavicencio.
I wanted to go to Veronica Sorales, the widow of the assassinated presidential candidate Villavicencio, speaking over the weekend.
They did not protect him as they should have protected him. The state was in charge of Fernando's security. The state is directly responsible for the murder of my husband, Fernando Villavicencio. The state still has to give many answers about everything that happened. His personal guards did not do their job. I do not want to think that they sold my husband to be murdered in this infamous way.
Andres Rouse, you're making very significant accusation talking about the president, President Lasso, being connected to narco traffickers. I wanted to ask you if you could further elaborate on that and also talk about President Lasso recently securing over 24 million gun cartridges, now declaring a state of emergency, announcing immediate mobilization of the armed forces. Do you think these measures will be sufficient to address the root causes of security and violence in Ecuador, something you're connecting him directly to?
Yeah, Lasso has been completely negligent in terms of the security policy in Ecuador. He is always reacting to problems on the ground. He basically dismantled the security ministry the coordination that used to exist between the police and the military intelligence with the civilian intelligence that we have in the country. Unfortunately, Lasso has been linked by the police intelligence to mafia organizations, including through his brother-in-law, Danilo Carrera, who is the current president of Banco Guayaquil, via Rubén Cherres. You see, in Ecuador, we've had recently these incredible murders. For example, the murder of Rubén Cherres. Rubén Cherres was a person linked to Lasso's brother-in-law, also linked to the Albanian Mafia, a drug trafficking organization. And this person was a key witness in Lasso's impeachment process. He was found assassinated only a few blocks away from Lasso's beach home in Santa Elena, a province in Ecuador. And this has not been cleared so far. People in the establishment media and in the government have stopped talking about Rubén Cherres. And we think that this type of behavior is similar to what happened now with Fernando Villavicencio. It is extremely worrisome, I insist. We are in these snap elections precisely because Lasso was linked to the narco-trafficking organizations, and there was wide opposition in the parliament against his government and his policies, and he decided to close parliament and call for these snap elections. So we're in this process precisely because of his links with the narco-trafficking organizations. Now, we think that we need an investigation. We need immediate support from all around the world. We need the international community put their eyes on what's happening in Ecuador. We know Lasso tried to postpone or suspend the elections after the assassination of Fernando Villavicencio, and we need to take care of our democracy. Now, we are really in a moment of great despair in Ecuador, and we've had a crisis very recently because of this assassination, and we need to go forward with these elections to seek finally truth, to seek reconciliation, to seek justice in Ecuador.
Are you concerned about speaking out so directly against the president? And also, what will happen to him after he leaves the presidency? Do you think he should be charged, that he should be put on trial?
Of course I am concerned. This is not the first time I have been outspoken about Guillermo Lasso. I was one of the people who accused him of having offshore resources hidden in tax havens and in, you know, trusts. And then finally the Pandora Papers came out and they showed that I was right about these accusations. I was also earlier this year, I accused Lasso directly of creating an offshore bank in Panama for money laundering purposes, to hide money from trafficking organizations and also from tax evasion. I was threatened by President Lasso himself, saying that he would sue me for defamation and other causes. And I said, bring it on. That way I could prove that I was right. He hasn't done it since, but he has also gone to Colombia to pressure the Colombian prosecutor general to accuse me of unfounded links. I then accused the attorney general, the prosecutor general of Colombia for that. So I have been in this place before, and I am sure of what I'm doing. Just like the Pandora Papers proved me right, I know that in this case, the links are very serious. And it is sufficient for anybody interested in what's going on in Ecuador to ask the question, who killed Rubén Cherres? And we will have clear answers that will help us respond who killed Fernando Villavicencio.
Well, Andrés Arauz, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Ecuadorian politician, economist, running for vice president of Ecuador, along with presidential candidate Luisa González. She's the only woman running for president in the 2023 Ecuador election. In 2021, Arauz ran for president and lost to Guillermo Lasso. Go to democracynow.org in Spanish for our Spanish interview that we'll conduct just after this show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Fire Roads. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
The Vancouver Art Gallery presents the Vancouver-based artist Mary Corey's most recent work, I Love, in the gallery's first floor rotunda until November 19th, 2023. 2023. Paying homage to the calligraphic nature of Arabic in her work, Corey draws inspiration from Henry Moore's sensuous sculptures and Zaha Hadid's organic architectural structures. To learn more about this exhibition, visit vanartgallery.bc.ca.
You're listening to